Ever since my mom died, I cry in H Mart. H Mart is a supermarket chain that specializes in Asian food. The H stands for Han Orum, a Korean phrase that roughly translates to one armful of groceries. H Mart is where parachute kids flock to find the brand of instant noodles that reminds them of home. It's where Korean families buy rice cakes to make Tteokguk, the beef and rice cake soup that brings in the new year. It's the only place where you can find a giant vat of peeled garlic, because it's the only place that truly understands how much garlic you'll need for the kind of food your people eat. H Mart is freedom from the single aisle ethnic section in regular grocery stores. They don't prop Goya beans next to bottles of sriracha here. Instead, you'll likely find me crying by the Banchan refrigerators, remembering the taste of my mom's soy sauce eggs and cold radish soup. Or in the freezer section, holding a stack of dumpling skins, thinking of all the hours that Mom and I spent at the kitchen table folding minced pork and chives into the thin dough. Sobbing near the dry goods, asking myself, am I even Korean anymore if there's no one left to call and ask which brand of seaweed we used to buy? Food was how my mother expressed her love, no matter how critical or cruel she could seem, constantly pushing me to meet her intractable expectations. I could always feel her affection radiating from the lunches she packed and the meals she prepared for me just the way I liked them. I can hardly speak Korean, but in H Mart it feels like I'm fluent. That was the first two-ish pages from the book Crying in H Mart by Michelle Zahner. And the reason that I chose this book that I had never heard of before was that I was, as you guys know, I work for the online school Rite of Passage, and I read this essay by a student. I was pretty floored by it. It was a beautiful essay. It was one of the most beautiful, like, first essays I've read by a student. And then I learned later that this was like the first thing she'd ever written and shared publicly, which just blew my mind. Her name is Danica Dela Cruz, and she did share this essay online, so I'll share it in the notes. She wrote an essay about her sister, about her sister's death. When I talked to her about how she wrote this beautiful essay, she said that she read this book, Crying in H Mart. And she said she just thought, okay, how can I make this sound like, or how would Michelle write this? I don't know if this is exact words how she said, but I was just like thinking, like, okay, actionably though, like, what did you do? You read this book, and then was there something specific that she did? Or, like, you know, teach me, how did you write like her? And she was just like, no, I would just like read the sentence out loud, and if it didn't sound like Michelle Zahner, then I would just rewrite it until it did. And I'm like, okay, so you're just a good writer, because I am not sitting over here reading Wild by Cheryl Strayed and then being like, all right, I'm going to write this next essay like Cheryl Strayed. Like, what? That's crazy. So anyway, yeah, you guys should read her essay. And I understand why she loved this book, because as you'll see today, I'm going to read a lot of it. And that's because I just love the writing. So Michelle Zahner, she is apparently a well-known singer. I've never heard of her, but she's Korean American, Korean mom, white dad. She was born in Seoul, Korea, and then grew up in Oregon. And then when she was in her mid-20s, her mom was diagnosed with cancer. And this book is an intimate telling of what that experience was like. So one of the themes of the book is food, which is pretty obvious from the title, Crying in H Mart, which she describes, as I just read to you, the description of H Mart. And she goes into so many more details and talks so much more about food in this chapter. But it got me thinking, okay, so what will be the different themes in my book? Because food's not the only theme of this book, but it is a major theme. And the thing about this theme is that food can be so visually described. It made it seem like so much easier to incorporate it because of that. So I was trying to think, okay, like, what's not only a theme that I want to be in my book, but also like one that can be easily described. And it's actually, I haven't really been able to think of anything good. The only thing that I came up with so far is obsession. I feel like at every point in my life, I've always been obsessed with something, and usually that's not a good thing. But there are sometimes that obsessions can be good. Like right now, I'm like kind of obsessed with doing this podcast, and I'm obsessed with, you know, making sure that I have something published every week. And I feel like that's a good obsession. But for the most part, you know, stuff with my control over my weight, I have an obsession with knowing what time it is. And I've been obsessed with people. So yeah, well, just something to think about, and then try to think like, okay, how can I show my obsession? Maybe like in each chapter, there could be like a stream of consciousness of like what went through my head that you could like see inside my mind of how crazy I was with these different things that I was obsessed with. I was obsessed with my teacher in high school. Like that could be fun to like talk about how like I went into the athletic director's office and like saw his information on the cork board, and my friends and I were like trying to get closer so we could figure out his address, and we did. I had his license plate memorized. We would go and drive by his house and just like get down on the floor of the car so he wouldn't know we were passing by. Like, so crazy. But anyway, yeah, it got me thinking about that. So I don't know if obsession is the thing, but it's fun to think about how I can weave a theme throughout the entire book. So let me get into some of these amazing descriptions for you. So, okay, first let me just talk about chapter one. So she's talking all about this Asian food store. And as we get to page 10, she says, "In the H Mart food court, I find myself again searching for the first chapter of the story I want to tell about my mother." So she's telling us right there, okay, this is what we're here for. I'm in this grocery store and I'm about to tell you a story. I'm going to talk to you about my mom. And then later down that page, she says, "Within 5 years, I lost both my aunt and my mother to cancer. So when I go to H Mart, I'm not just on the hunt for cuttlefish and three bunches of scallions for a buck. I'm searching for memories." And so then we're going to go back in time. And guess what? Chapter two, she's going to talk about her upbringing. But first, let me give you some food details. So in chapter two, she says, "What I never seem to forget is what my mother ate. She was a woman of many usuals. Half a patty melt on rye with a side of steak fries to share at the Terrace Cafe after a day of shopping. An unsweetened iced tea with half a packet of Splenda, which she would insist she'd never use on anything else. Minestrone she'd order steamy hot, not steaming hot, with extra broth from the Olive Garden." And then there's like so many more details. And then here's more. "She drank two glasses of Chardonnay every day, but would get sick if she had a third. She ate spicy pickled peppers with pizza. At Mexican restaurants, she ordered finely chopped jalapenos on the side. She was allergic to celery." So the more details that she shares, the more I find myself thinking about details from my own life. So reading this, I was like, what do I know about my mom? What are those intimate details? I think if you can think of details that are so specific and just write them down, those are interesting. If you can just like observe a person, especially someone that you know really well, or go back in time into your memories and just like think of things that used to happen or anything. It's just a way to bring these stories to life. Another thing that this made me think about was with my mom specifically, and like thinking about how I can write about her, because my book's not going to be about my mom, but I am going to obviously write about my mom. When I think of her, I think that our relationship, there's so much nuance and there's feelings and such subjectivity. And what Michelle does in these lines is she takes the relationship out of it. So you can think of these details as things that are visible to the naked eye, but maybe that other people don't necessarily see because they don't know her as intimately as you. Here's another description of food example that I just want to share. It's much further on in the book on page 70. "Blissfully, I laid my palm flat, blanketed it with a piece of lettuce, and dressed it just the way I liked. A piece of glistening short rib, a spoonful of warm rice, a dredge of samjang, and a thin slice of raw garlic. I folded it into a perfect little satchel and popped it into my mouth. I closed my eyes and savored the first few chews, my taste buds and stomach having been deprived for months of a home-cooked meal. The rice alone was a miraculous reunion, the cooker having imbued each kernel with textural autonomy, distinguishing it from the gluey, microwavable bowls I'd been surviving on in my dorm room." It's just so good, right? It's like, it's so descriptive, and I can like, my mouth is watering picturing eating this. I don't even know what this is. And this thing with short rib and rice, and I don't even know what samjang is, some kind of spice or sauce. I don't know. But she's not only describing the food here, she's also showing you the contrast of what her life has been like at college and now coming home to this something that her mom has made for her. Okay, I just have two more descriptions of food because they're just so good, and then I'm going to be done with it, but I'm going to read them to you. So then in chapter 9, she wrote, and she's talking about, I think this is her cousin, Yunmi Imo. So she says, "At night, he would phone in orders of Korean fried chicken and a growler of cast draft beer. We'd sink our teeth into the crackly skin, hot oil gushing triumphantly from its double fried crust as we broke into the glistening dark meat and finished with a cold crunch of the pickled cubes of white radish that came with every delivery." And then a little bit later on, she says, "It was July, and we'd ordered Pat Bing Su to share to save off humidity. This rendition was far more elaborate than the homespun efforts of my childhood. Its base, a perfect soft powder of snow, slathered in sweet red beans and garnished with pristinely cut strawberries, perfect squares of ripe mango, and little cushions of multicolored rice cakes. A fine web of condensed milk drizzled over the sides, and vanilla soft serves towered high on top." I have no idea what this dessert is, Pat Bing Su, but I can picture it, I can taste it, and I want it. And then you can, I don't know if you noticed, but there's like a bunch of alliteration here with the S's. So we've got stave, soft, snow, slathered, sweet, strawberries, squares, sides, soft, serve. Like, it just, it makes the sentences flow and have this like really nice rhythm to it. Back in, we're going back to chapter two now. So, and this is going back to her childhood and kind of describing the type of mom that her mom was. And she says that her mom was really hard on her. And she said, "When my friends got hurt, their mother scooped them up and told them it was going to be okay. Or they went straight to the doctor. White people were always going to the doctor. But when I got hurt, my mom was livid, as if I had maliciously damaged her property. Once, when I was climbing a tree in the front yard, the notch I used to hoist myself up gave out from under my foot. I slid 2 feet, dragging the skin of my bare stomach on the coarse bark as I tried to regain my footing, falling 6 feet onto my ankle. Crying, ankle twisted, shirt ripped, my stomach scraped and bloody on either side, I was not scooped into my mother's arms and taken to a medical professional. Instead, she descended upon me like a murder of crows. How many times, Mommy, say, stop climbing that tree? Umma, I think I sprained my ankle, I cried. I think I have to go to the hospital. She hovered over my crumpled body, screeching relentlessly as I writhed among the dead leaves. I could have sworn she threw a few kicks in. Mom, I'm bleeding. Please don't yell at me. You will have this scar forever. I cham wan ilia. I'm sorry, okay? I'm sorry. I apologized over and over again, sobbing dramatically. Big fat tears and insistent stuttering wails. I pulled myself toward the house with my elbows, gripping the dry leaves and cold dirt as I stiffly dragged my limp leg forward. Ayago, Dwasa, that's enough. Hers was tougher than tough love. It was brutal, industrial strength, a sinewy love that never gave way to an inch of weakness. I wanted to share this story because this was seemed like one of those stories that Michelle could never forget. It's like seared into her memory. And you can tell with the description that she has of the experience of falling from the tree and how much pain she was in and her mom yelling at her. And what I've been experimenting with is writing down these stories now to see which ones feel like they mean something greater, like if they've affected me in some ways, because we all have these stories that we remember from our childhood. Why do we remember them? I don't know. But I sometimes like, I know these stories, but I don't write about them because they feel insignificant or maybe like I can't remember enough to write a complete story or like I need to have some like big takeaway. And so I just read this essay, which I'm going to talk about in more podcasts, but I read a David Sedaris essay called Santaland Diaries. It's so fucking funny. Oh my God. I was struck by the ending because he tells this story. It's like a 45 page essay. And he tells this story about how he worked as an elf at the mall during the holiday season. And the essay takes you through the, you know, when he first sees the ad in the paper to him working the job through to his last day, which is ends up being on Christmas Day. And at the very end, he's just wrapping up and he's like, it's his last day. And he's saying goodbye to like the manager that's on duty or whatever. And then the essay ends. You know, he's not like, the way I end all my stuff is like, here's what I learned and here's the lesson and here's the value. And let me tell you what, why this is important. And he just fucking ended it. And I was like, yes, I want to do that. I want to just not always tell you everything that you need to know. Like you can take from the story what you want. And so this week I wrote, I'm actually sharing it. Yeah. I guess it'll already be shared by the time this year. So this week I wrote my newsletter and I told a story from my childhood that I've known for years. Like I've known it so well, but I've never written about it because I don't know what the point is. I just know that I remember it and it's a funny story. And at the end, I was like, okay, I'm not gonna give a lesson. I'm not gonna say the value because I don't even know what it is. And I couldn't help myself. I finished the story and I kept on trying to like make it into something important. And I was like, no, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. So then I just left it and I let it hang. And the purpose of this is not to have this message sent out to my readers that's tied up with a bow, that you guys all get something out of it. The purpose is for me to get these stories out and figure out for myself which of these stories is important. You know, do I have a story like this, like Michelle had, that she will never forget, that is ends up being like a good description of, as a whole, you know, the kind of upbringing she had and the kind of mom her mom was, for this one way that her mom was. I think it's really important for me to write these stories and share them, because it's way different to write them and share them than to just have them in my head or to just talk about them. Okay, so then a few pages later, we're still in chapter two, she writes, "In marked contrast to the other domains of parental authority, my mother was loose when it came to the rules regarding food. If I didn't like something, she never forced me to eat it. And if I ate only half my portion, she never made me finish the plate. She believed food should be enjoyed and that it was more of a waste to expand your stomach than to keep eating when you were full. Her only rule was that you had to try everything once." Was such a magical approach to food, like such a loving way to parent. And now I say this now, as someone who's gone through a lot of struggles with my relationship with food. But most importantly for this, I thought it was really important to show you that she's showing both sides. Like whenever you're writing about someone in your life, you can't only show one side of the person. Like you have to show both sides, no matter their relationship to you. I have written in the past about my brother. I've written an entire essay about my relationship with him. If any of you read that piece, you would know that I do not have a great relationship with my brother, and I don't think very well of him. And that is reflected in my essay. And now I'm starting to learn, like, you have to show everybody's, both, everybody has more than one side to them. My brother is not just like a bad person. And I was thinking how, like, if I do, I don't know if I'll write about more about him in my book or not, but if I do, you know, there are some things that I can share that can make the reader more sympathetic to him. Like, I want the reader to get the full picture. And so, like, yeah, my brother has not been very nice to me for a long time, but I also wasn't very nice to him. And my brother got bullied a lot as a kid. He was small. My mom took him to, she got him into this like early preschool or kindergarten or something, but they had a rule where you had to be potty trained. And so my mom forced my brother to potty train when he was too young. He wasn't ready. And he peed himself a lot. He had a lot of accidents. I think it was really humiliating for him. I actually like only learned these stories like in past recent years. And it just, I think about how that can affect a person in the long run. And so if I do write about my brother, I'm going to try to come from a much more loving place so that it's not just like, my brother sucks. So in chapter three, she talks about how every other summer, her father would stay behind to work in Oregon, and her mother would go to Seoul to spend 6 weeks with her mom's side of the family. And so she's at this Chinese restaurant with her cousin, and she says, "On the mezzanine, he would take me to see a 6-foot-long fish tank that housed a baby alligator. It remained there year after year, blinking sleepily, until it grew so big it was unable to step forward even an inch, then disappeared altogether." And then she just like moves on to something else. And then like 3 pages later, we're coming to the end of the chapter, and she writes, "If it wasn't for my mother, I might have wound up just like that pet alligator at the Chinese restaurant, caged and gawked at in its luxurious confinement, unceremoniously disposed of as soon as it's too old to fit in the tank." So I wanted to point this out because we talked about this with Green Lights. Matthew McConaughey told a story about his mom going on an extended vacation. And then you're kind of like, huh, I wonder what that means, because it was in quotes. And then he comes back to it at the end of the story a few pages later. And this is the same kind of thing that happens here. It's where they're leaving a little bit of a question mark for the reader, but not enough to make them think that they've missed something. Like, huh, extended vacation, I wonder what that means, but it's not pulling me out of the story. Like, and here it's like, huh, the baby alligator disappeared. Like, what's that all about? Why do we even need to know about this baby alligator? And then she comes back to it at the end. It feels like such a tiny detail. Like, it has very little to do with the actual story that it's easy to just keep reading. So I'm trying to think, like, where can I plant these little teasers throughout my book? Like, I think that the more of these, the better, actually. In Green Lights and this book, Crying in H Mart, they did it a couple times, but I'm like, this is really exciting. Like, it's really fun when it happens where you plant a seed, it doesn't interrupt the flow, but then I can return to it. And you, as the reader, feel this satisfaction that I close the loop. So I was trying to think of an example, and this is probably like a really silly example, but just bear with me. So when I was pregnant with my daughter, and my daughter is my second born, my right big toenail fell off. It just like split in half and then it fell off. And then shortly after that, my left toenail, big toenail, did the same thing. It just split in half and fell off. And it didn't hurt. But every time my toenail would grow back, it would just split off and split and fall off. And you guys, this is still going on now. So it's been going on now for over 2 years. So, you know, shortly after it fell off, I went to the doctor and he was just like, huh, I don't know what's going on. I'm going to send you to a podiatrist. So he sent me to this podiatrist. It was this horrible experience. This guy was the worst doctor I've ever seen. He was a total narcissist. He was like, so dismissive of me and what was going on. And he was just like, your toenails are fine. Just put some Neosporin on them. And then he started to like, he was like telling me parenting books I had to read and like telling me about this program that, my husband had to take our daughter to when she gets old enough, like just unsolicited advice that I did not want from this guy. And, anyway, so then I kept living with it because they just kept falling off because this doctor was an asshole and didn't help me at all. So then I finally went back to my doctor and he prescribed me this cream that he wanted me to use, and it kept happening. And so the way that I deal with things a lot in my life is I don't deal with them. So that's why this is still going on, because I'm just like, well, yeah, they keep falling off, but they don't hurt. And I'm just going to live with this, this annoyance, this weird thing. And so I finally was like, okay, let me schedule like try to see a different podiatrist. So my doctor schedules me with this other podiatrist and I just went and I am sitting there and he's talking to me and he's like telling me that, my toenails look like, it looks like trauma, like some kind of trauma has happened to my toenails. And I'm like, what? And he's like, so trauma can be either like something blunt force happened like one time, or it could be little bits over time that there's like some kind of like force or pressure on my toenails. And I was like, huh, that's really interesting. I have no idea. Like, I definitely don't think something happened with blunt force, because I feel like I would have remembered that, because that would be painful. But if it's happening over time, like, I have no idea. And we're like going through till the end, and he doesn't think that they're like, there's like a fungus or anything. And the toenails look healthy. So he like gives me this like cream to put on them. And he asked me about at the very end, he's like, what, like, just be careful with like the shoes that you're wearing. And I was like, the shoes that I'm wearing. And he's like, yeah, like, do you like wear, anything on your feet in the house? Or I was like, oh my God, I wear slippers in the house, and I started wearing them like a year before I got pregnant with my daughter, and they are, because I have hardwood floors and my feet really hurt in my house, so my husband wore these slippers that he really liked, so he's like, you should get these. So I got them and I love them, but they're very snug, they're tight, and they press down on my feet. And you know, I thought that was a good thing, and like, they're nice and cozy in there. But after all this time, I think I've been doing this to myself with these slippers that I've been wearing. Now, I just told this whole story and I feel like this was probably really boring. I think it could be interesting if this is one of those stories where it's just like throughout the book, we keep coming back to it, and I would shorten it and make it much better than what I just told you. But, and then if there's like some kind of, like how with Michelle, how she did this like metaphor where the baby alligator was like her, and maybe there's something in here where that I could pull a metaphor out to make this story much more interesting and have it just be at different points in the book where it comes back in and you're like, oh, her toes again. Here we go. What's going on here? This might have been a really bad example, but I think that the point is that my mind is thinking in this way now of how to plant these little seeds where it doesn't take you out of the story. But then when we come back to it later, you're like, oh yeah, I remember this. Cool. We're here again. Okay. On page 158, I'm kind of skipping around now. This is kind of similar to what we were just talking about. So she writes, on the headstone, we arranged to record her name, birth, and death days, and lovely mother, wife, and best friend. Lovely was an adjective my mother adored. She told me once, if pressed to describe me in a single word, lovely would be the word she'd choose. She felt it encompassed an ideal beauty and ardor. It felt a fitting epitaph. To be a loving mother was to be known for a service, but to be a lovely mother was to possess a charm all your own. And then, like four pages later, this is, after the funeral. She says, we took her remains to the gravesite. The procession was private, just two cars full of the family staying with us. Her plot was under a tree nestled high on the cemetery sloping hill. I looked down at the headstone. Dad, it says loving, I whispered. That's bullshit, he said. So they messed up the headstone and they wrote loving instead of lovely. So that's how the chapter ends. He just says that's bullshit. So this is like page 162. So then on page 229, so like way further down, there's only like 10 pages left in the book. She wrote, I put together a band and we drove down I-95 along the East Coast, across the long stretch of I-10 from the marshes of Louisiana through the empty deserts of West Texas and Arizona, up I-5 along the majestic cliffs and mountains of the Pacific Shore, and back through the misty valleys of Oregon, where I left flowers on my mother's grave, the headstone corrected and finally reading lovely. So again, the first story when they're it's the day of the funeral and they've messed it up and she's just like, oh my God, Dad, it says loving. And he says, that's bullshit. You're just like, oh my God, I can't believe they messed up the headstone. And then that she just leaves it. She doesn't say like later they would correct it so that it says lovely. Like she waits almost, how many pages? I can't do math. Almost 100 pages later. And she says, you know, in just a passing, like the headstone corrected and finally reading lovely. Like she lets us know like they eventually corrected it, but this was a better time to tell us. And it feels so much more satisfying that she waited to tell us. I'm like, oh, I'm so glad they fixed the headstone. So again, it's just like spacing out the story so that it has more of a punch. Page 73, we're into chapter 6 now. She talks about her dad. My father often blamed his work for the distance that grew between us. I was 10 when he took over his brother's business and his workload practically doubled. But the truth was, his new position coincided with the purchase of our family's desktop computer, which was when I first stumbled across the paid affairs he'd been scheduling with women online. It was a secret I kept from my mother my entire life. In my notes, I wrote, holy crap, like she drops bombs like they're nothing. And I love that. It's very opposite of the book that I've been reading now. I'm reading Finding Me by Viola Davis, and she uses a lot of exclamation points in her book, and it's really off-putting. I find it much more shocking and thrilling when the writer doesn't make such a big deal out of it. Because when you make a big deal out of it, it's like you're trying to tell the reader, like, this is a big deal. And it's like, let the reader, like, give the reader credit. Let the reader decide for themselves what is a big deal and what isn't. So then, still talking about her dad, this is a pretty shitty thing that he was doing, like having affairs and then she had to keep this a secret from her mom, like pretty shitty. About 8 pages later, she is talking about how she blames her dad and she has a lot of anger towards her father. But then in the next pages, she writes about his upbringing. And then it makes it easy to sympathize with her dad. So here's what she said. So she talks about Ron, who was her dad's older brother. Ron, who was 6 years his senior, perpetuated the abuses he'd endured onto my father, boxing him into unconsciousness and slipping him tabs of acid when my father was only 9, just to see what would happen. Like, holy crap. Can you just imagine that? Like, how horrible is that? So again, this goes back to my point about showing the good and bad sides of a person. Like, no one can just be only good or bad. You know, the stuff that her dad did, more than just like the cheating, there's a lot of bad behavior that he had in his life. And, you know, you think about like what happened to him in his upbringing, and she kind of lets us into that here. Really quickly, this is chapter 9. Michelle describes how she felt at receiving bad news that the cancer had spread. "You should sit down," my father said. I slunk to the floor of my bedroom between half-packed cardboard boxes. I held my breath. "It didn't work," he croaked. I could hear him on the other end bursting into sobs, his breath heaving. "It didn't shrink at all?" I asked. It felt like he'd pushed the length of his arm down my throat and was gripping my heart in his fist. Okay, so just reading that line, it felt like he'd pushed the length of his arm down my throat and was gripping my heart in his fist. Like, just reading that makes me want to cry. And I can feel it. Like, I can feel what that feels like. And I wanted to share this because it's so not a cliche. Like, I talk about this a lot in my sessions in Rite of Passage about not writing cliches and like not just like talking about your, like saying your feelings. And a lot of people hear like the cliche would be like, my chest tightened, my head hurt. Like, these are cliches. And Zauner makes you feel what she's feeling. She's more descriptive. And whatever is your first thought of like a feeling word, it's too easy. It's not written well enough. So you have to think harder. You have to try to imagine like, what did it feel like? And she does such a great job of that. Okay, so right after finding out this news, her mom, Michelle's mom, tells her that she wants to take a trip to Korea so that she can say goodbye to her country and to her older sister. They're talking about it, and then Michelle makes this comment. She says, "Maybe I can film it all on my camera. I can make a documentary or something of our time there," I said. It was my instinct to document, to co-opt something so vulnerable and personal and tragic for a creative artifact. I realized it as soon as I said it out loud and became disgusted with myself. This is admitting something that you're ashamed of. And when you do this, or when she did this, it just made her so much more relatable to me. So Minka Kelly just wrote a memoir called Tell Me Everything. You guys know Minka Kelly. She was the actress from Friday Night Lights and Parenthood. And she was recently on Dax Shepard's podcast, Armchair Expert, which is also one of my favorite podcasts. And she talks about how sharing the shameful stuff is freeing. And here's what she said. "Something about all of this now being out of my hands. None of it has any power over me anymore. It's also why I start the book with the most humiliating and embarrassing and scary part of my past, and the one I carry the most shame about. I worked as a girl in a peep show at a dingy adult video store on the side of a highway in Albuquerque at 17 years old." That's how she starts the book. And I love that she said, like, you know what? I'm going to start with the most shameful thing. And then when she did that, it loses its power. And I relate to that so much. It's why I like to share all the darkest parts of myself. But the thing that this really showed me is that, you know, with the start of my book, I keep thinking about starting at rock bottom. But this is interesting. Maybe instead of starting at like the worst moment, it's the most humiliating moment, which I'm not sure what that is for me. And maybe I'm not going to change it, but something to think about. So back to Michelle, like, think how easy it would have been for Michelle to leave this little bit out. I mean, it was such a tiny little moment that she immediately regretted. She could have just so easily been like, I'm not going to put that in there. She could have pretended it didn't happen. But this is why I love her, because you know what? It did happen. And we do have these moments where we say something stupid or we say something that we regret. And you know what? The truth is like, her mind did go there. Like, yeah, let's document it. When I was a senior in high school, 9/11 happened. I had no concept of what it really meant. Like, I was in third period calculus, and my teacher turned the TV on. And as the TV was on, the second World Trade Center was hit. And I saw it happen live. And I didn't understand it. My mind could not understand that people were dying at that moment. There was no sadness for me. I was kind of like more like freaked out that all the adults were freaking out. I mean, I'm a senior in high school. Like, I should have known more. But anyway, the after school that day, me and two of my girlfriends, like at that point, I always had a video camera with me. And we were like, we need to record something. This is history. Like, we need to go. And we were like, let's go interview we were going to go interview our friend's dad because he seemed smart. I don't know like what we were doing, but we went to his house and we were like sitting out in our car with my video camera. And we were like trying to make an intro. And every time we would start it, we would be like, today is September 11th, 2001. And we would just crack up laughing. And that's really embarrassing to admit that to you. But like, this is the shit that like, it happened. And so like, I could be like, oh God, I'm not going to tell anybody that. That's so embarrassing. I can't believe I did that. Or I can share it. And guess what? I just shared that with you. I actually don't think I've really shared that with many people. And it does. It feels better to get the stuff off my chest and just put it out there. Chapter 11. There's 20 chapters in this book, by the way. So we're on page 131. And this is the chapter about Peter. And Peter is her boyfriend at the time. Peter is a big person in her life for this book, because she was with Peter for like 2 years before her mom got the diagnosis, and she's married to him now. So he was with her through this whole thing. And in fact, while they're, while her mother is like, you know, she gets the diagnosis that like, she's definitely going to die soon, Michelle's like, we should get married. And they do, they get married. But this is when she meets Peter. So she writes about him, and I wanted to include it because, you know, I always talk about having a chapter about Sam and how he's a big person in my life. And so it's just reaffirming that this is really important to include the person you're with if they are a part of your story. So she wrote, when she first met him, what I could hear was Peter's laugh, a high-pitched honking sound that was like a cross between a Muppet and a 5-year-old girl. And that was it. I was in love. I love this description, and it actually made me think about Sam, because not that his laugh sounds like that, but similarly, I am also very attracted to Sam's laugh, and his laugh reminds me of George McFly from from Back to the Future. It's one of his laughs where he doesn't laugh like this all the time, but when he thinks something's really funny, you like, if you're in the same room as him and he does this laugh, like your head will turn. You'll be like, what is that noise? And I think it's very sexy. So I related to this so much, and it was really fun to read about this whole introduction of Peter. And, you know, in a really dark and painful book and story, it was refreshing to have this very sweet love story in the middle. Okay, this next thing is also really funny. Let me just read it to you. Back at home, I called again. Oh, she's talking about, I should explain. She calls her mom to ask her to walk her through like instructions for a recipe. So she says, back at home, I called again to have her walk me through the process, frustrated that her instructions were always so convoluted, even when it came to making rice. What do you mean put my hand on top of the rice and add water until it covers it? Put water in until water covers your hand. Covers my hand until where? Until it covers the top of your hand. I held the phone against my shoulder, my left hand submerged underwater, laid flat on the surface of the white rice. How many cups is that? Honey, I don't know. Mommy doesn't use cup. This is so fucking funny, and it totally reminds me of my mom. Like, my mom, she even made me a cookbook with instructions on it. And if you read it, you might even think it's like instructions for dummies, because I am constantly like asking her to clarify, and she'll just be like, she'll, on the ingredient list, she'll just be like, capers. And it's like, what do you mean capers? Like, am I going to use the whole jar? Like, how many capers do you use? Capers is not just like add salt and pepper to taste. I think so many people can relate to this with like family recipes and how the recipes are never exact. Okay, last chapter. Let me back up. So after her mom died, she was living at her parents' house for a little bit. And while she was there, she was just like working and trying to keep herself busy. And during that time, she recorded an album in her parents' basement. And then she like, every single song was, you know, it was about her mom, and it was about her grief and just all the things around her mom's death. So this is the last chapter. Here's the first lines. About a year after Peter and I moved to Brooklyn, the little record I had written in the cottage at the bottom of my parents' property started to receive a surprising amount of attention. Oh, sorry, not their basement, at the cottage. My mother's image graced the cover, an old photograph of her in her 20s in Seoul, wearing a white blazer and ruffled shirt, posing with an old friend. It came out in April, and that summer I was offered a 5-week tour opening for Mitski across the United States. At the same time, an essay I had written over the course of a few weeks in the evenings after work titled Lost Love and Kimchi was selected as Glamour Magazine's Essay of the Year. Okay, so we're in the last chapter and we're talking about writing. This happened in Wild and Green Lights. Same thing, and they get to the end and they start talking about like their writing, the process, and for Michelle, this tour as well, not just this essay that she wrote, but this tour is the culmination of the book. Later in this chapter, she's like talking about the tour and she says, naturally, we'd finish in Seoul. So, I mean, this is a really nice way to end it. It's like she is going to finish the tour in her birthplace and her mother's home. And then a couple pages later, she says, I hadn't believed in a God since I was about 10 and still envisioned Mr. Rogers when I prayed. But the years that followed my mother's passing were suspiciously charmed. I had been playing in bands since I was 16, dreamt of succeeding as an artist practically my whole life, and as an American, I felt entitled to it in spite of my mother's aggrieved forewarnings. I had fought for that dream thanklessly for 8 long years, and only after she died did things, as if magically, begin to happen. If there was a God, it seemed my mother must have had her foot on his neck, demanding good things come my way. That if we had to be ripped apart right at our turning point, just when things were really starting to get good, the least God could do was make a few of her daughter's pipe dreams come true. Oh man, rereading this just... This book was hard to read. It's like this absolutely heart-wrenching and tragic story ending with this light and love and beauty of like... She's living on her dream. She's always wanted this for herself and it was always a struggle and now like she's doing it and it kind of just, it feels as if it just like happened. This passage that I just read, there's 7 more pages left and I kind of wish that she ended it more closer to here. But then she goes on and then she kind of starts to lose me in the last pages because after the concert, they go to a bar and there's like a bunch of characters, like music producers and stuff that we don't know that she's talking about. I just found it, you know, less engaging because I don't know who these people are. And she's introducing them now at the very end of the book. And then the next morning, her and Peter spend time with her family in Korea. And then there's like a whole section on their final day in Seoul. And it was kind of just like, I don't know, just kind of whatever. And then the very last lines of the book, she's with her family and Peter in Korea, and they're at a karaoke bar. She's just singing a Korean song with her aunt. And that's how she ends the book. And it was very unsatisfying for me because I was like, I was sure she was going to come back to the food theme. And she didn't. And I just thought that would have just been the obvious, easy way to tie the book back to the beginning. At one point in the book, she mentioned that her mom wanted to come to reincarnate as a tree. And so when she wrote that, like, you know, somewhere in the middle of the book, that she mentioned that. And I was like, oh, maybe she's going to come back to this at the end. And she doesn't come back to it. And you know, you can't force it. If like, there's no, you know, she didn't have any magic with a tree after her mom's death. You know, I'm not going to fault her for that. But those were just like 2 things that I thought of. It was like, oh, she could come back as a tree. And then, and the food stuff. And instead we ended a karaoke bar, which just kind of felt, I don't know. It didn't feel like it went with the rest of the book. Again, endings are hard. And overall, I really enjoyed this book and I loved Michelle's writing. The feeling that I got reading this and Wild was similar. And by that, I mean, during the days, I would think about how much I wanted to get back into their worlds. Like, I would be like, oh, I want to get back on the trail, hiking the Pacific Crest Trail with Cheryl. Like, I want to see what she's doing. And then with Michelle, I was like, oh, I want to get back, and this sounds kind of morbid, but like, I want to get back into the book and like grieve with her and like go through this with her and find out how she's doing it. The way I decide if I love a book is if I can't wait to keep reading it. And so I felt like that with Wild and Crying in H-More and Green Lights. But the past 2 memoirs I started reading, that has not been the case. So I started reading Norm Macdonald's memoir, which is called Based on a True Story. I'm not sure how far I got into it, but I was like into it in the beginning and like it's funny and the writing is good. And then it got to a point where it got so absurd, which I will talk about in a later podcast, but like I closed it and I was like, oh man, I think he just lost me. And I told Sam about it and he was like, well, you should stop reading it. And I was like, no, I'm not going to stop reading it. There's still like a lot to learn from it. But then what happens is I don't look forward to the reading as much and my reading slows down. There's just so many like good books, like amazing books for me that it's like, why would I slog my way through a book that I'm not completely in love with? So I put it aside and I started reading Finding Me by Viola Davis, which I mentioned earlier. I have been like trying to convince myself that I am more into this one. But the first night I was reading it, Sam was like, how is it? And I was like, I'm not sure yet. And then the next day he was like, how is it? And I was like, oh no, it's good. It's good. But it's not for me. I'm 2/3 of the way into it. And I like feel like I have to finish it. It's a great story. It's like a very powerful story, but the writing is very distracting for me. With both of the books, I know that there's a lot to learn and there's a lot for me to know, like, okay, this is like what I don't want to do in my book. So regardless of whether I finish them or not, I am still going to talk about the things I learned. So this week I am going to start writing down my notes on these books for the next episode. I'm not sure. It depends on how many notes I have. I'll either do both of them and maybe the episodes will be a little bit shorter, or depending on how much, maybe I'll combine them. So yeah, that's what we'll do next time. As for I just read that Santaland Diaries by David Sedaris. That was from the book Holidays on Ice. I am reading Holidays on Ice like sporadically and periodically as I'm reading these other memoirs, whenever I'm kind of like in the mood for some David Sedaris writing, because it's so good. So I think as I'm doing these episodes, I will also interject if I've learned something from any of the David Sedaris essays. But please keep the recommendations coming. I have really appreciated you guys reaching out. And anytime you give me a rec, I am putting it in my notes. I have The Tender Bar by J.R. Moringer on deck. That's the only book I have currently. I need to start ordering some more books. So let me know what you got, if there's a memoir that you love, and I'll see if I can add it to my list.